Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Money Crimes is a podcast all about the dark side of finance and sometimes murder. Find Money Crimes on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Thanksgiving Eve, Wednesday, November 27th. Highs today of 77, and then tomorrow a 60% chance for showers. And I'm trying to get more details on the timing of this, when exactly it's expected to rain. They got a cold front coming through, and Black Friday is going to be like cold. You know, it's going to be really nice November weather. Get out, do some Christmas shopping and all that stuff. But tomorrow, not so much. If you're planning on the fireplace, I hope you got the air conditioner working, because you're going to need it before that. Then when the front comes through, and for the weekend, highs of 73 tomorrow, then a front comes through, highs of 59 Friday, 58 Saturday, 62 on Sunday, and it stays in the 60s until Thursday, warms again. Maybe we'll get another front by then. We were talking about Black Friday and weather and cooperating being a good day to go shopping. Ted Rossman joins us now, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst, to talk about Black Friday deals and shopping and all that stuff. How you doing, Ted Rossman?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you.
What do the surveys show from Bankrate survey about people shopping and inflation, credit card debt, living paycheck to paycheck? There's a lot there for you to unpack, but we got 20 minutes. Take your time, Ted.
People are definitely going to be shopping. The National Retail Federation and MasterCard and Deloitte and others are expecting something like a 2 or 3% increase over last year. Now, that's not exceptional. I mean, that's more or less in line with inflation, but it is still growth. The Thanksgiving weekend is really kind of more of the midpoint of the holiday shopping season now. It used to be the kickoff not too long ago. Now it's basically like Black Friday comes in October. Really, especially the past few years, Amazon Prime Big Deal Days and Target Circle Week and other early October promotions have really gotten the holiday season started earlier. But still, we found that 59% of Americans are likely to buy on Cyber Monday, 53% on Black Friday, 50% on Small Business Saturday. It's still an important weekend for retailers.
When it comes to who's spending more, who's spending less, does that break down according to demographics with ages and different groups or generations? How do you measure that?
The age breakout is very interesting, because Gen Zers and millennials are the most likely to be shopping on all of those days, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. It's Small Business Saturday that most surprises me for those young adults, the fact that 6 in 10 Gen Zers and millennials are shopping on Small Business Saturday versus 46% of Gen X and 40% of boomers. The holiday season has stretched out. It's gotten more online. Young adults are certainly participating in that, but they're also hitting the local community stores on Small Business Saturday, which is a little bit of a throwback, but it does show the desire to support the local community, and also the fact that small businesses rate better on customer service and unique gift ideas. They don't necessarily have the lowest prices or the widest inventory, but there is something to be said about meeting with a knowledgeable local shopkeeper, kind of going on this treasure hunt for unique gift ideas that maybe you didn't even know you were looking for. And there can be a social element, too, that you round up some friends and family and hit the stores and go out to lunch and go out to a movie. And that sort of thing appeals to people, including Gen Z and millennials.
It sounds like a Supreme Court case, stress v. cheer. It's not. It's a survey that you guys did. And I find it interesting about holiday shopping and how people responded to what applies to them, what are their feelings about shopping, et cetera. Ted, what did you guys find?
Many feel like their budgets are strained, but yet they're spending anyway. They're spending thoughtfully. That's a key theme this year. And it is one of the best years for discounts in a while, because retailers are acknowledging the situation. They are bending on price. 25-30% off. That's kind of the floor for a lot of retailers. Sometimes we're seeing 40% off, 50% off, sometimes even more. People are spending, but they're spending very thoughtfully, and especially on physical goods. It's been harder to move that kind of merchandise the past few years. People have been more apt to put money into experiences like travel and dining and concert tickets, and experiences have done well ever since the pandemic ended. Less so for clothes, toys, and electronics. That's another reason why retailers had to offer deep discounts early in the season. So at the end of the day, even though credit card balances are at record highs and people are still stressed by inflation, they're still spending. They're just being especially deal conscious.
So what are the hot items this year, Ted? Do we know yet?
Yeah, I don't know if I have any specific names on toys or anything like that.
More like,
I do know that...
What's the word I'm thinking of? Like a classification? Is it electronics? Is it because you mentioned not experiences. I was just wondering what people are buying or looking for. Jewelry?
Yeah, I feel like the holiday favorites tend to be things like clothes and toys and electronics. Those have not been selling as well the past few years in general. I do think experiential gifts are still hot, even though some of the enthusiasm has tempered a bit. This is still going to be a record year for travel. There's still been tremendous concerts and sporting attendance and restaurants. And even though the momentum has slowed a bit on experiences, like 2022 was really the revenge travel kind of year. But then last year was another record, and this year's a record. So I feel like experiences are still a big deal. Retailers of electronics are hoping that a product replacement cycle comes around. So many people stocked up in 2020 and 21 amidst the pandemic, and now maybe some people are starting to come back around on that. That's what they're hoping, at least. There are early signs of a recovery for things like phone sales, TVs, computers. Some of these people who bought one a few years ago, now they're in the market again. But in general, the past few years have been much more about spending on experiences than on stuff for the home.
So when it comes to, I remember as a kid, as we're having this conversation, it just popped into my mind as a kid going to the bank with my parents and seeing a Christmas club. And asking my parents, what's a Christmas club? What's all that about? And they explained it was something where people saved every year to all throughout the year to buy Christmas presents. I've not been to a bank in a long time. I do it all electronically. I don't know if there are Christmas clubs anymore. Do banks still push that? Do people save to buy Christmas presents, or is it all done credit card now?
We see it a little bit, especially at credit unions, but it's not as much of a in-your-face kind of advertisement. I love the concept. It's something that people can definitely replicate on their own. I'm a big fan of that pay-yourself-first kind of idea, set money aside every paycheck. It's something people could maybe start now or start in January for next year. It's a little late for this year, but still, you still have maybe two or three paychecks before the end of the year. Anything you save can help ward off that high-cost credit card debt. The average credit card charges about 20%. The average store card charges about 30%. So that's one to be especially wary of this holiday season. A lot of those get peddled aggressively at the checkout counter. You want to think about that total cost of ownership, too, where sometimes buy now, pay later sounds like a viable alternative. Things like Affirm and Afterpay and Klarna. Sometimes it's a good deal, but sometimes it encourages overspending. So you want to think about that total cost of ownership.
It seems interesting to me. We're talking to Ted Rossman, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst, about the holiday shopping season. You asked, thinking about the upcoming holiday shopping season, which, if any, of the following do you expect to apply to you? Top of the list was 42%. I'll do most of my holiday shopping online. But then at 7% comes in and says, I'm willing to go into debt for holiday purchases. But it would seem like a lot more than 7% of people are going into debt for holiday purchases. Is there a disconnect there or not? What do the numbers say?
There is a big disconnect, because half of credit card holders already carry debt from month to month and at an average interest rate of about 20.4%. Not to shame people. If you have credit card debt, you have plenty of company, and it's often for practical reasons. The biggest cause is an emergency expense, something like a medical bill or car repair. Second place is day-to-day living. You don't want to make it worse around the holidays, though. So the advice would be, set money aside in advance. maybe cut back on gift giving this year. If it's really not in the budget, maybe even set expectations with family and friends, like, hey, could we only buy for the kids this year? Or could we pick one adult's name at random and buy for them instead of the whole extended family? If you're a good baker, if you're a good crafter, maybe you can make something. Maybe you could go to a thrift store or get something at a secondhand online shop. The point is, you don't want to dig the hole any deeper. And frankly, a lot of people don't even remember what they got for the holidays last year. So you don't want to go into long-term debt for this sort of thing. It is important to spend thoughtfully. A lot of people are doing that this year, but it's the cumulative effect that's important. It's not just the holidays. It's the fact that prices in general have gone up 20% since early 2021, and wages have gone up 17%. So everybody's paying more for housing and food, and it's just really pinched the household budget.
Well, Ted, thank you for your time. I remember this. I know that there's no worse feeling in making this mistake as a younger guy than, you know, being Santa Claus in November and December. And then when that credit card bill comes in January, you realize, how in the world, how am I going to, right? You don't want to put yourself in that position.
That's right. Yeah, that's really the important thing, is just going in with a plan and, you know, make a list, check it twice, stick to it. A lot of people have a lot of financial pressure, and, you know, the National Retail Federation says that the average holiday expense is about $900. Well, if that's $900 in credit card debt on top of the average, which is $6,400, according to TransUnion, that's a tough situation. I mean, it's such a divide between the half of cardholders who pay in full every month and are taking full advantage of rewards and other buyer protections, and then the other half that's carrying debt from month to month. That's the problematic situation, and that's where 6 in 10 people have had credit card debt for at least a year, and it just kind of builds off itself. So if you have credit card debt, don't dig the hole any deeper. Think about getting a 0% balance transfer card. Avoid interest for up to 1 month. You know, you could also work with a reputable nonprofit credit counselor like Money Management International. There are some things you can do.
And when you transfer that balance, shred that card, because you don't want to charge anything else. Thank you, Ted. I appreciate your time. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure as always. Ted Rossman, Bankrate Senior Industry Analyst, 626. Now traffic, WWL. Yeah, you're right. 6:45, quarter till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our good friend Mike Strain, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Happy Thanksgiving, Mike Strain.
Happy Thanksgiving. It's almost Turkey Day. It's time to start sampling the dressing, right?
Yeah, you
get everything
right
together today for a huge feast tomorrow, family and friends. Look, this is one of my favorite holidays. Of course, it's a good eating holiday, right? It's time to celebrate. It's good to be home, and it's good to be. I'll see, you know, my extended family. All my rowdy cousins are coming to town, so it's going to be a good time on Strain Farms.
The rowdy half is coming?
Oh, and the other half, too. They're all coming.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they balance each other out. Let me get to this real quick, Mike. You know, I get the market bulletin, and you sent me a subscription to this, and I appreciate it. Louisiana Department of Agriculture, Culture and Forestry Market Bulletin, which is a great read. But right on the front page, it says, feed thy neighbor. And I think that's important. Talk about that, if you will, please. About food.
It's very, very important. You know, and one of the things, and we talk about every day, is fundamental duty of mankind is to feed the world. Mm-hmm. And when you start looking at what we can do to help, you know, the food banks, that's a huge, and the food banks, their needs are growing. The food banks serve those that are not on government assistance, those that are falling through the cracks. We work very hard to assist with that. Also at the farmers markets, you know, we have the Seniors Farmer Market Assistance Programs. But also, when you look at everything that we can do, you know, anything you can do to assist in the food banks, donating food, that goes a huge, huge way. And if you ever have time, volunteer just for a few hours at a food bank and see what's going on. But and by that same light, I've been traveling quite a bit, working where we can continue to grow and export food to the world, our world neighbors. And agriculture is the greatest form of diplomacy, and there's a growing need for food, and that's a huge deal. And right now, here in America, there are more people than we realize that are struggling to put food on their table, and we've got to do everything in our power to help that. We've got to stabilize our food prices, but no one in this country should go hungry. And again, help feed thy neighbor.
Mike, one thing I wanted to talk to you about as well, and we'll talk about Louisiana table in a second, but when it comes to tariffs, now, you know, we're going to talk about tariffs in a little bit, and I don't care if it's President Trump or President Biden. I'm all for American manufacturing. I'm all for helping out local people. People also have to be able to afford the stuff that they eat and drink and all that stuff. Tell me about, you're a smart man, Mike, and you're involved in agriculture. Hell, you're the commissioner of the department. Tell me about tariffs, when they work, when they don't.
Well, tariffs are really designed to level a playing field. If you have tariffs for your product going into a country, then you should have equivalent tariffs to level the playing field so that you have access to those markets. Mm-hmm. Now, retaliatory tariffs, when you put tariff on an import because they have a tariff on a different export, that's different. That can disrupt the overall economies. And so we have to be very careful. Tariffs can be an important tool if the other countries aren't playing fair mm-hmm. with their trade agreements. You know, if you have an imbalance of trade and a severe imbalance because they have rules that you don't have and it makes it where you just can't compete in their market, then a tariff put in place basically to try to level those playing fields. So we have to be very, very, very careful so that we don't cause a market disruption that, at the end of the day, lowers the value of the commodities we're trying to sell overseas.
So you don't, I guess it would be like you don't just hose the entire yard. You got to look at what part needs water and what part doesn't. Would that be accurate?
Well, that's right. They are used strategically. Again, I'll give you a for instance. Okay. We talk about seafood. You know, the majority of seafood consumed in the United States outside Louisiana, right, is imported. And so when you look at if India or another country is dumping seafood at below cost, and they're supplementing their producers, then there needs to be a tariff to put on that particular product, whether it's cherries that are now going to the East Coast from China or, you know, or shrimp coming from India, then to level the playing field, to level the value. So don't dump product here. And one of the things we have to look at, if you look at China's new directive is that they are going to start massively manufacturing everything. Meaning they will be importing raw commodities, making products, and then dumping them onto foreign markets. Mm-hmm. And so that's their new initiative. Well, we got to make sure that they don't send those products here below our cost of production to dominate our market and put our people out of business, whatever widget we're talking about, whatever it is. But for commodities, you know, many countries will send products here you know, below our cost of production, often below their cost of production, because their government will supplement the producers of that and then want to dump and dominate our market. And the tariff is there to say, okay, no, we're going to level the playing field.
And much like a big box store running out of mom and pop, and then all you got to do, the only people you have to do business with is a big box store, they can charge whatever they want at that point.
That's correct, and the other part of that, you realize if we lose our ability to feed, clothe, and provide for our needs here in America, we'll be at the mercy of those other countries. So just as you recall, you and I can recall the fuel shortage mm-hmm. when we couldn't get fuel.
Yep.
Right. I mean, there was no fuel to buy at the stations because we came so dependent on foreign oil, and now we're the largest producer of oil in the world.
I was a little bitty baby boy, Mike, but I remember my parents telling me about it. Let's just go with that, okay?
Unfortunately, I remember it very well. You know, you would, based on your last name and others, where you were in the alphabet, you could buy gas every other day if you could find it. Only 5 gallons. People couldn't get to work. It brought this country to its knees.
I remember it clearly, Mike. I was just lying about my age.
Okay.
I remember not being able to go on a date because I couldn't get gas. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Mike Strang, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, on those rare occasions when I could actually find a date I couldn't get gas. Traffic now, WWL. 6:57 and a half, talking to our friend Mike Strang, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, getting you ready for Thanksgiving. Mike, let's happy up and talk about an all Louisiana table, some of the good Louisiana products we can get and put on our Thanksgiving table.
My goodness. Well, you've got to have some Louisiana sweet potatoes, those evangelists, those Beauregards, or the Jolies. Mm-hmm. Of course, you've got to have some citrus products for your fruit salad. You can go and find some mustard greens, turnip greens, kale. And what about pecans?
Mm-hmm.
Got to be Louisiana pecans, some of those Bajorons, those Little Eva, pecans and Cane River, and of course your pecan pies, sweet potato pies, local bell peppers, tomatoes, corn, cabbage, broccoli, and so many mushrooms, fresh pickles, peppers, jalapenos, local honeys, okra, gumbo. Think about that, right? Think about the Thanksgiving gumbo with Louisiana rice. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And look, when you cook your gumbo, don't forget to put some crabs in there as well. You got to have some oysters in there, your oyster dressing. My goodness. It's just, as we say, certify your celebration. Look for those Louisiana products. And for your spices, look for that certified Louisiana family of spices. And really, as we say, spice it up and do it right. And it's going to be a great, great Thanksgiving. We just can't wait. There's so many wonderful spices and rubs. You know, rub on your turkey, you know, and rub on any other meats that you're cooking. And, of course, when you're cooking your gumbos and everything, and just hope everyone has a wonderful, wonderful time.
Right back at you, Mike. Good luck with the Rowdy Cousins.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we may put them to work. You know, this is a big farm. And after y'all have been fed, guess what? We got fence to fix.
Wear them out.
After that, they all – yeah, that's right. That's right. And I'm looking out for them. So we can eat again, right?
There you go. Wear them out. Get them hungry. Let them take a nap. That'll settle them down. Mike, y'all have a blessed Thanksgiving. God bless y'all, all right?
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on every week. We appreciate it. Same to you, sir. Mike Strain, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. When we come back, we're going to talk to Colin Grabo, Associate Director of the Herbert A. Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies. I don't care if it's Republican, I don't care if it's Democrat. When we talk about tariffs, I just want it to be good for the economy and the country. Back in a flash, WWO. But Friday and through the weekend, highs are going to be near 60 degrees with lows in the 40s. So it'll be kind of fall-like, and we'll appreciate that, I guess. Colin Grabo joins us now, Associate Director of the Herbert A. Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies. Talk about tariffs. How you doing, Professor?
Good morning, Tommy.
I'm sorry. I called you professor. I didn't mean that sarcastically. I presumed you were. Are you?
I am not. No. Okay. No. You can just, Associate Director at the Cato Center for Trade Policy Studies. That'll work.
So let's talk about tariffs. Because, look, you know, whenever you talk tariffs, people automatically jump to the political corners of Bidenist, Trump that. My own standpoint here is, first of all, I don't know if anybody knows what's going to happen. It'll be my first question to you. Do we know what's going to happen? And secondly, so long as it doesn't hurt the country or hurt the consumer, I'm all for it. So take me through, Colin, if you will, tariffs 101 and what's been done, what might be done, and et cetera.
Yeah, so let's start with, like you said, tariffs 101. So tariffs are a tax on imports. That's what they are. They're a tax on imported goods. So when those goods arrive in the country, you pay a tax on it. So if we have, 5% tax on a $100 item, you're paying $105 for that item. You can kind of think of it like a sales tax, something like that. And that means that anything coming into the country is going to cost more than would otherwise be the case if these tariffs are implemented. So we're talking right now in the context of possible tariffs on items from Mexico and Canada. So you want to build a house, that lumber you're going to use from Canada, well, that's going to cost more. The fruits and vegetables you're going to buy from Mexico, that's going to cost more. And a lot of people, I suspect, think of tariffs in terms of, items on the store shelves, that those cost. But let's also remember that roughly half of all imports into this country are not consumer goods, they're inputs. They're used by businesses here in the United States to make things. A great example of this is the auto industry. There's a lot of tight linkages between auto companies in Canada, the United States, and Mexico. So take auto parts. Auto parts may cross the border between the U.S. and Mexico 7 or 8 times before they're actually installed in a vehicle. So this means businesses will have to pay higher costs for the things that they use to make things. So obviously consumers get hit, businesses get hit. That means they're less competitive. And then, of course, we all worry about Canada, Mexico, trading partners. They're not going to take this standing down, right? They're going to say, well, you're going to do that to us. We're going to do something back to you. And there's going to be retaliation. And obviously that's going to hurt American businesses as well. So from a lot of different perspectives, these are quite harmful.
So How likely is any of this to happen, or is this, because, you know, if President Trump always talks about, you know, what was his book, The Art of the Deal, and being a good negotiator and all of that stuff, I don't know whether he is or not, but is it, could this be part of a negotiating ploy with an end game of what?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I think it's interesting to note that in the days since the announcement of these tariffs to be imposed on day one, supposedly, of the new Trump administration, the markets have basically shrugged this off. You know, there's been no dramatic fall in the stock market. In fact, I think it's actually gone up. Mm-hmm. This suggests to me that people are skeptical that Trump will follow through. As you noted, Trump, he's all about the art of the deal. And, you know, the fact that he's announcing this 2 months ahead of when he takes office, to me suggests there's a high likelihood that this is a negotiating tactic. I'm setting out an extreme, this is my opening bid, so to speak, an extreme position, and we'll negotiate, and where we'll actually wind up could very well be a much different place. It's worth keeping in mind that, of course, we had a first Trump administration, so we have a track record to look back on. And Trump, you know, he did things like he threatened to pull out of NAFTA, saying it was a terrible trade agreement. And in fact, what happened is we renegotiated it, made some, you know, basically tweaks, wasn't massively overhauled. And then he said he was good with it. So there's a history of Trump, you know, making statements, but then where we actually end up is perhaps in a different place.
So let's look back at his first administration and talk about his history on trade and tariffs. From your standpoint, Colin, how'd he do? Because I don't know.
Yeah. So I don't think it's a great record. If we look back, what he did early on, some of the first tariffs he imposed were tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum from a range of countries. And if, we've had some government reports. We have time, you know, to study these and what was the impact. And if you look at those tariffs in particular, well, on the one hand, that's good for the steel and aluminum industries, right? That means less competition. That means that prices go up so they can expand production. That's good for them. But there's a whole lot of industries out there that use steel and aluminum to make things. You know, obviously the construction industry, cars, auto manufacturers, a whole range of folks, you know, people who make machinery. And government studies show that, yeah, these tariffs benefited steel and aluminum producers by, I think, something like $2.5 billion. But then the industries that use steel and aluminum were hurt on the order of, you know, $3.3 billion, I think, for a net loss there. And that's kind of the story of just tariffs writ large. So that, you know, there were, of course, also tariffs imposed on goods from China. China retaliated. U.S. Our farmers were hurt because China bought less stuff from the U.S. in retaliation. So the track record is not great, but you could also say that the amount of tariffs were not as drastic as perhaps what Trump initially indicated. So I think that's kind of my read on the first Trump administration.
So somebody texted in, and look, I want to encourage the audience to text in here because I'm sure you, Colin, know more, have forgotten more than any of us will ever know about tariffs. Somebody texted in and said, what is the guest talking about? These countries already put tariffs on all goods going to those locations. That includes Europe, China, and South America. Somebody else texted in and said, are there tariffs on U.S. goods? We'll talk about all that when we come back with Colin Grabo, Associate Director of the Herbert A. Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. That's accurate? Colin, I got that right?
Yes. Okay, thank good. You. Thank you.
You bet. 721 traffic now, WWL. I 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking with Colin Grabo, Associate Director of the Herbert A. Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, about former President Trump's, President Trump's tariffs and some of the things that he's announced. Text comes in and says, countries already put tariffs on goods going to those locations, including Europe, China, and South America, and are there tariffs on U.S. goods? Thoughts, Colin?
Yeah, so if I understand the listener correctly, they're saying that, hey, basically, we already have to, you know, other countries impose tariffs on us, and we do the same to them. you know, in the context of Canada and Mexico, it's worth remembering that we signed a free trade agreement with both countries back in 1994, or took effect in 1994, NAFTA, which then was renegotiated by President Trump, now called the USMCA, which ensures that, you know, the vast majority of goods going back and forth between the U.S. and Canada are tariff-free. That's the whole point of the agreement. And this gives, of course, lower cost to consumers, but also provides certainty to businesses that they can trade back and forth with companies in those countries, integrate their supply chains, and know that there won't be tariffs on those goods. Well, that, of course, has been upended now. We don't have that certainty anymore. And yes, you know, if you want to look more broadly, of course, other countries do impose tariffs on U.S. goods. But President Trump, you know, he didn't link this latest threat to other countries' trade practices. You know, he didn't say, hey, we're going to raise our tariffs on their goods because they're, you know, they have tariffs on our goods, and that, you know, we'll do some tit for tat reduction. You know, he linked this to migration and, I believe, fentanyl. So it's not, he didn't even raise, you know, threaten this in the context of other countries' trade actions. And then just lastly, I'll say, you know, whatever other countries are doing, if they're making, from my perspective, mistakes by putting tariffs on U.S. goods, to me, it doesn't, you know, just because they have bad policy, I don't think it's worth emulating that and then, you know, adopting that and kind of mirroring those practices.
You know, every action has a reaction. A friend of mine sent me some stories here, one from Bloomberg. China's snapping up cheap Brazilian soybeans as Trump returns. Another one from Reuters says, China trade war threatens U.S. corn, soybean exports as South America stands to gain. So basically, China, as I understand it, is investing major money in developing South American farmland and doing some things to, I guess, eliminate the need for American exports or lessen their dependence on American exports. And if that's the case, then what does that do to our soybean industry?
Yeah, that's right. So as I mentioned before, our farmers, our agriculture sector, they were some of the, you know, hardest hit by the tariff war, the trade war we engaged in with China under the first Trump administration. China, you know, big purchases of U.S. soybeans and other crops. And when you know, they imposed tariffs on U.S. soybeans, you know, China responded by shifting purchases to Brazil and other large producers. So I think we can absolutely expect, you know, more of the same, you know, going forward. If you know, the U.S. imposes tariffs on, say, Mexican avocados, you can see, you know, there'll be a shift to Peruvian Mexicados, but, you know, at a higher cost. And of course, if, you know, Canada and Mexico, they have promised, or Mexico's president has promised, to retaliate against the U.S. Canada did retaliate 4 or 5 years ago when the U.S. imposed steel and aluminum tariffs on them. I expect they'll do the same again. And that will mean that people will look for alternative sources instead of buying various products from the U.S. to look to alternative suppliers.
Every action has a reaction. As I said earlier, this is going to manifest itself for the prices of consumers. And they got the midterms coming up. So one way or the other, that's how it's going to be judged, I would imagine, politically. I don't mean to get you into a realm that you don't want to go, but that seems to be the real world.
Well, it is worth, you know, you talk about politics, it is worth interest. It's worth pointing out that, of course, we just had an election where it seems that one of the motivating issues for a lot of voters was high costs, high prices, inflation. And it's curious then that, you know, Trump would immediately, you know, or threaten on day one to impose tariffs, which will further raise prices. So from a political standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And again, it just makes you wonder if this is a negotiating tactic or we'll end up in a different place.
We'll see. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Have a nice Thanksgiving. We come back, we'll talk about homelessness in the city right now. Time for WWL First News. We've been talking about turkey and dressing and Thanksgiving and all of that stuff. And if you want a little preview and you want to do some good, and you want to help out and maybe even get your Thanksgiving dinner a little bit early, all on one delicious piece of bread, you can do it over at Parkway. And with that, we're joined by Justin Kennedy, the manager over at Parkway Bakery and Tavern. How you doing, Justin?
I'm doing all right, Tommy. How the heck are you, man?
I'm okay, man. Thanks for coming on again. I wanted to give you one more shot at this because it's a weird kind of deal the way it's working out with Thanksgiving not being where it normally is. Seems like it's a longer period. Anyway, tell me about what's going on today at Parkway, and I did it for the Turkey 2024.
Sure. So we've done it every Wednesday past and every Wednesday in November. We have four Wednesdays. Today's the last Wednesday in November. And we do a sandwich. It's everything you're going to get tomorrow, right? It's your roasted turkey. It's homemade stuffing. It's homemade gravy, cranberry sauce, all on French bread. And, you know, it's gotten so popular over the years, we harnessed it for a fundraiser with the Al Copeland Foundation to fight cancer. And we're doing just that, man. And I know I was on the phone with you a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. We're looking to hone in. We're about $32,000. We're looking to hone in about $40,000 raised with this fundraiser.
That's awesome, man.
Which is absolutely blows it out the park from what we've done in the past.
So tell me, if you skip the line, you go to Parkway.
So you go to Parkway Bakery. We're right here in Mid-City, 538 Hagen Avenue. You know, I've said in the past you can call in, but I don't know if that's going to happen today. I'm probably about to get, when I get off with you, I'm probably about to turn the phones off because we have so many orders and the line's going to be down the street.
What about the register, like, you know, thing? Skip the line. Can you still do that?
Yeah, exactly. You can get on to get here. There's going to be a line. Come in. If you want to skip the line, you can donate to the Al Copeland Foundation. You did it yourself, Tommy. Yeah. You get a T-shirt. You get a drink. You get sweet potato fries. You get the sandwich. You get to skip the line.
Ice cream sandwich.
You get an ice cream sandwich. Yeah. From New Orleans Ice Cream, and you get to say you donated all that money to cancer because that's where it's going.
It's a good-looking T-shirt. So you go to Parkway Poor Boy. Tell me how to go on. Can you still do this online, Justin?
We don't have it online. You can call in 504-482-3047. The line's open at about 8:30. But like I said, I expect to shut the lines down soon because we got to take care of people who are waiting in that line.
Right. So if somebody wants to skip the line, can they still do it, I guess, is what I'm asking, and donate?
Oh, yeah. We have a booth here. You don't even have to worry about going online anywhere to try to buy a ticket. Just, we have a booth here. Walk past the line. Walk into the outside patio. You'll see a Al Copeland Foundation booth. You can pay that ticket right there, and they'll bring your food and right to you right there.
You got instantly. People lined up already or not?
Yeah, we got a couple.
No kidding, that's crazy.
We got a couple, man, and you know, it's this is going to be the best day yet.
Tell me real quick about the Al Copeland Foundation, what they do.
Al Copeland Foundation was started by Al Jr. in 2008 in lieu of his father passing of this cancer that there was no cure for. And since then, they've worked with LSU and helped develop a drug that is saving lives from this cancer, Merkel cell carcinoma, that there was no cure for. So Al Copeland Foundation is the best secret in town when it comes to cancer treatment. Right now they're working on, like helping people out in rural areas who can't get connected to a hospital, you know, via online doctors and nurses. So it's very special. It's very dear to our hearts. And Al, look, he puts 100% of that money that's raised back into the foundation. There's nobody on the payroll. That's what I love about it.
Thank you, Justin. I appreciate your time and your efforts. You know that. Go to Parkway today. Bring your checkbook. Bring your cash. Can you make a plastic donation? Do it that way?
You can make any kind of donation. Tommy, whatever you got, man. If you bring a goat, I'll trade a goat for you.
Okay. I know the patio is pet friendly. I've seen dogs. I've never seen a goat out there. Hey, thank you, Justin. Have a nice Thanksgiving, all right?
All right, you too.
And it's a good-looking T-shirt, y'all. I'll tell you that. It really is. 743, 17 till 8. We'll talk about homelessness in the city when we come back on WWL. 748, 12 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Martha Kegel, Executive Director of Unity of Greater New Orleans, about what's going on with the homeless encampment sweeps. Good morning, Martha. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Tommy?
I'm okay. I will say this. I think in terms of, this is just my opinion. You don't have to get involved in this, Martha. We'll tell you what. Go ahead. Let me have you on, and I'll give my opinion, which concerns, if we're going to get worried, if the governor's office could be worried about what's going on in the city, I would be more concerned with the Plaza Tower falling apart than I would with the homeless encampments. But that's just me. Tell me what's going on with the homeless sweeps and where are we?
Well, as I understand it, there's a temporary restraining order in place right at the moment. We haven't been involved with that, but that's my understanding. I think that's just temporary, though, to make sure that the city laws are followed in terms of giving people proper notice that they don't lose their possessions. But I will say that, you know, I think moving people from place to place doesn't solve homelessness. And the unfortunate thing about that having been done is that the Unity Collaborative of organizations in the city and the state had been working really hard together harmoniously to house people, and we had a active list, and we had done a lot of work with more than 75 individuals, and had gotten them approved for different housing programs, which is a complex process, and we're in the process of housing them when all of a sudden they were moved, and so that undid a lot of our work, and then people ended up getting scattered, and now we can't find them, and they're now in other neighborhoods, and you know, their presence is probably causing some problems for other neighbors and other businesses elsewhere. So nothing was accomplished by that, and I would hope that going forward we can all continue to work harmoniously, because what we know is that the solutions to homelessness are proven, and it's housing, rental assistance, and case management services. And we're, you know, we have a lot of expertise in doing that. We don't have quite enough resources, considering how large our poverty population is, but we have more resources than we've ever had right now. And if we all just work together, we can make a huge difference.
Let me say it a different way, Martha, and maybe I shouldn't have started the way I did. Let me say it this way. You don't want people to stay on the streets. You're not advocating for people to live in homeless encampments. There is a plan in place. There is a process underway. People have been enrolled in the process. Things are moving. The wheels are in motion. This just disrupts everything and makes it harder to get people off of the street. Although maybe politically expedient, although maybe, you know, by moving a block or two down the street, it might make it look a little bit better in the short term for some people, it is extremely disruptive to the process that you have in place. Is that accurate?
That is absolutely accurate. And in addition to that, a lot of the folks we're talking about do suffer from serious mental illness, and they suffer from paranoia. And if you, you know, have police officers involved, you know, forcing people to move, you have just disrupted the trust that you've built with that person, and you may never get the opportunity to voluntarily house them again. They may, you know, just completely distrust you from, you know, now going forward. And so, you know, the trauma that caused is also an important issue. The lack of, you know, the disrupted trust is a very important issue. It doesn't really matter what our various motivations are for wanting to end people's homelessness. We can have multiple motivations. It's bad for economic development. It's bad for the quality of life for every citizen. It is a tragedy for the people actually suffering from homelessness. As long as we work together and use the proven, cost-effective, compassionate solutions, we can make a huge difference, and we are making a huge difference. In the last 13 months alone, we have housed 1,292 people experiencing literal homelessness.
Martha, I don't know if you were out there or not, but everything I've seen and I've heard from people that were, they tell me that the police officers, the state police, were extremely compassionate. They got the sense that they didn't really want to be out there, but they were just doing what they were told to do because they realized that they were disrupting a process. Did you want to weigh in on that at all?
I would agree with that. I think that the state police tried their very best to try to minimize the disruption, and they tried to be as compassionate as possible, and kudos for them for trying to, you know, make a bad situation not as bad as it could have been.
Final thoughts if somebody wants to get involved or help Unity or help with a homeless situation, because, you know, table pounding accomplishes nothing. I always use the example, Martha, of a community event, a parent-teacher meeting. Chairs just don't set themselves up. Somebody has to do the work behind the scenes. And when it comes to this, again, table pounding, grandstanding accomplishes nothing. If somebody wants to get involved, what do?
The best thing to do is to go to our website, unitygno.org, unitygno.org. You can either give directly to Unity or you can give to any of our member organizations, which we have listed. You can give to Catholic Charities. You can give to Volunteers of America, Harry Thompson Center, Travelers Aid Society, Easter Seals. Many organizations are part of the work that we do. At any given time, we are housing 3,500 people with disabilities previously rescued from homelessness. And as I said, we just house another almost 1,300 people. And we are hoping to house 500 more people this winter. And we can do that with the community's help. Another thing people can do is donate gently used household goods to our warehouse. Again, if you go to our website, you can see how to do that, unitygno.org.
Thank you, Martha. Happy Thanksgiving to you. God bless all the work you do. 7:55, 5 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 8:15 on this Wednesday morning before Thanksgiving. One of the things we're thankful for, Ronald Surpass, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police, currently a professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, a consultant to many departments, started as a street cop, right? Tell me about your career with NOPD. Ronald, good morning.
Well, good morning. Happy Thanksgiving to
Same
you
here,
and everyone
sir.
Who's listening. I joined the police department in June of 1980. My first assignment out of the academy was the French Quarter. Walked a beat on Bourbon Street, rode a horse on Bourbon Street, became a sergeant in the central city, the 6th District, rode motorcycles, DWI commander, became a lieutenant, was the assistant commander of the French Quarter, and then went to one of the patrol districts, got promoted to captain, was in charge of the crime lab, one of the most fulfilling jobs I ever had that I never thought I would like. Then I became a major for 6 years and deputy chief for 5 years, and then Washington for 3, Nashville for 7, New Orleans for 4.5, and that was it.
There you
That's
go.
That's a wrap. 34 years.
And now here you are. So let's talk about this thing with the French Quarter shooting and the ankle monitor and the judge that was notified, because I saw, you know, all we're friends with all these people, right? Rafael Goyeneche with the Metropolitan Crime Commission. I saw him talking about how the thing should never have been pled down. But then I talked to Jason Williams yesterday, and he told me that, well, even after it was pled down and there was some kind of problem with the casings or something, some kind of evidentiary problem, they had to plead it down. But even after that, the guy violated parole, and the DA said, no, keep him in jail, and the judge let him out on an ankle monitor after he was let out. And I don't have the note in front of me here, but I think it was like 40-something times that he violated the ankle monitor release. And the judge was notified, and, you know, Matt Dennis over at ASAP, they're on top of it, notified the judge that this guy was violating his order, and the judge didn't do anything about it. Now you got one person dead, 3 shot, if I don't have the story in front of me here. I think that's what it was. You got 2 in jail, I think, 2 at large, 1 in jail, 2 at large. Tell me if you're going to go back and do an anatomy of this, Chief, and where this failed, and if something like this could be prevented at all. Just tell me about the whole, your take on all of this.
Okay, so, you know, we start with this, that in any city, about 2 to 3% of that population, and it works out across the nation as well, less than 2% of the entire nation of the country is actually incarcerated in state prisons or federal prisons for crimes that require jailing. So first off, we're not talking about a huge population. Secondly, judges in Louisiana are elected every 10 years. Maybe that's a little too long. I don't know. It seems like these decisions fade in the background when someone's up for re-election 9 years later.
I didn't realize that. It's a 10-year term?
I think so. I could be wrong,
no,
but I think it's a 10-year term.
I didn't realize that. Okay,
yeah. It could be. I know they have to be an attorney for 10 years before they can run. I might have got the numbers. But here's the thing. Judges at the state level are elected by the people as a representative democracy of what the people want. Do the people of New Orleans want this kind of crime, right? So that'd be the way of looking at that. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I mean, I get what Mr. Williams said. I get what Raphael said. I trust and respect both of them in different ways. But guess what? The public just doesn't understand. You got an electronic device on an ankle, and a judge is notified repeatedly that a violation is occurring. Why isn't this guy one of the 2% who's incarcerated? Mm-hmm. Why is he the one that they keep taking chances on when 98% of the people are held hostage by these 2%? And that's kind of the way I look at it, is that every crime requires a victim. That means somebody got hurt. And every time you look at these repeat violent offenders, Tommy, they all have the exact same profile. They're later in life than they can be touched by maybe some of the help programs that you would like to think would help. Sometimes they're just not going to matter to them. And they continually show to the criminal justice system that they do not intend to comply. This guy is clearly an example. I don't intend to comply. You can put two bracelets on me. I'm still not going to comply. And if a judge or a court or a police department doesn't hold those people accountable, what's to stop them from continuing to do so? Now, I get the people who are all concerned about criminal justice reform. There's a lot of reasons for reform I think we can all agree on. But I think everybody agrees with no. Repeat violent offenders do not deserve the right to walk the streets of citizens who are healthy, happy, and following the law. So it's a breakdown in the system. It's a breakdown in the clear system of this guy sending the message he wasn't going to pay attention to the law.
Yeah, let me take a break. The only reason I wanted to bring it up, look, I consider both Raphael and Jason friends, as do you, I'm sure. But mm-hmm. I just think this is a case study of how the system failed and how it led to a brazen French Quarter shooting at a couple of different levels. And it goes to how once somebody decides to break the law, what it takes to keep them in jail and at what point it can fail. And we'll go through that, okay, when we come back?
Mm-hmm.
All right, good. Ronald Surpass, our guest. 6 years, the term for a judge that's elected. We looked that up just, and not trying to call you on anything, Chief. We just wanted to make sure we got it accurate. 820, traffic now, WWL. All right, 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Just to be clear, and I don't want to get lost in the weeds here. A state judge, I think, is 6 years. Supreme Court judges, appeal court judges, 10 years. That's not the point. Let me go back with Ronald Surpass here and talk about both. You got the second line shooting and you got the shooting in the French Quarter. From that point, Chief, and I think, you know, people watch Law and Order, they don't understand sometimes the way things really work. In the criminal justice system, So a crime happens, police go out, they try to gather as much evidence as they can, right?
Correct.
And then after that, go ahead. Do you take me through it?
Yeah, so the police will respond to the scene and they'll render aid and they'll protect evidence. The system's based on evidence so that a defendant who has all the rights to defend themselves can challenge the evidence. Then they bring it to the prosecutor, who has to bring it to a level called beyond reasonable doubt, where a jury would convict 12-0 or the defendant would plead guilty. Oftentimes you see these multiple defendants plead guilty because it allows them to evade more serious punishment because they usually know that they've done it. Then the judges have to decide what type of confinement, if they're guilty, are they going to continue to be under? Is it as a result of statutory requirements, like if you kill somebody, it's life without probation and parole? Or is it a graduated scale, 5 to 10? And the key piece here in the shooting that happened in the French Quarter is the judge was engaged in making decisions about when that offender was going to be released on an ankle monitor. And it's the judge's responsibility at that point to enforce their rule. The police, the sheriff, the monitoring system, they don't have to be psychics. I'm listening to that commercial you did a few minutes ago. The judge doesn't have to be a psychic. If someone continues to refuse the orders of the court, you don't need psychic intervention to know this person does not intend to follow the rules. Then those cases go to the opportunity for people to challenge evidence against them. And if they win, they win. If they lose, they lose.
So when it comes to the volume of cases that criminal courts handle in the country, there aren't the resources for every case to go to trial. I'm not talking about this specific case. I'm talking mm-hmm. about in general, and it goes to plea bargaining. I was watching a rerun of Better Call Saul last night for whatever reason. This popped into my head.
Great show.
It is, but that the plea bargain, if plea bargaining were to go away, the courts would be overwhelmed, would they not?
Absolutely. Not only would the courts be overwhelmed, but those who are guilty of a crime who are looking to make a better deal for themselves wouldn't even have the chance to do that. Plea bargaining has two complete sides. One is it fair to people who can't afford good lawyers to plea away their future? There's probably some really good questions to ask about that. But Tommy, what about the multiple armed robber who's up on his third armed robbery who says, look, I don't mind pleading if you give me 5 years instead of 50. So plea bargaining is a two-way street where you have to be sure that people are being given good legal advice that's proper, and people are going to take a chance to reduce their sentences when they know they're guilty. So, yes, you can't manage this system with every case going to trial, and there are two questions. Are people being fairly advised and people using it to reduce sentences for their conduct that they know they did?
And the other part of that is, from the prosecutor's standpoint, and this goes back to the police work and the preservation of evidence, do they have a case with which they can get a conviction? Because at some point, it's kind of like the Wheel of Justice casino. You got to figure out whether you're better off getting half a loaf or none, right? Or a whole loaf?
And that's part of the other part. That's the other half of discretion. The police can't enforce every law violation, and prosecutors can't try every case. So it's a synthesizing of reality of case information versus what you might be able to get. By and large, prosecutors and police are on the same team, but they play on two different sides of the ball. It's that natural tension that has to occur. Prosecutors don't accept cases just because police made them. They have to apply their understanding of the law and what they can do.
What does a district attorney, a DA's office investigator do?
They make the they close gaps that the police weren't able to close at the time they made the arrest. Sometimes much better information comes out later. DA investigators are crucially important, and Jason, like any DA, deserves to have as many as they can have because it helps the system work better for the defendant and the victim, but the victim first.
That is an important part of this that a lot of times doesn't get attention, don't you think? The investigators.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think the DA office needs them as much as police need police because they're kind of doing two different pieces of the same pie, but they have two different responsibilities, and that's an important thing that they should be staffed for.
Thank you, Chief. Have a nice Thanksgiving. Appreciate your time, as always.
You too.
Ronald Sir, past professor, practice Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. We'll talk with Steve Geller about the Saints and the Rams when we come back right now, 8:30, time for WWL First News. Look, enjoy your Thanksgiving, eat a lot, but make sure you rest it up when the Saints battle the Rams in the Caesars Superdome going for three in a row. Later game, no. Game day starts at 11. First take, Steve Geller, Jeff Nowak, 1 o'clock. Bud Light countdown to kickoff with Bobby Hebert inside the dome. Loach Level, Gate B Atrium, presented by Craig's Electrical and Generator Service, 305. Do yourself a favor. Turn down the TV and turn up the sound on WWL and sync it up. It's not that hard to do, especially if you listen on the radio. Then after the game, sound off and listen to Deuce and Hoss, of course. Then Jeff Nowak on the sideline. Sound off on the Ciroc Point after with the Cajun Cannon, Saints Rams. 10 hours of wall-to-wall coverage starting at 11 a.m. on Sunday on WWL and a free Odyssey app. A big part of that coverage, of course, Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. You do a great job, Steve, on Sunday with the Cajun Cannon. How you?
Doing good, Tommy. Looking forward, obviously, Thanksgiving and then hopefully feasting on the Rams on Sunday. They're definitely one of the teams in the NFL that I despise.
Sacrifice the Rams. I like the way you said that when you talk about feasting them. I never thought about that, but let's do that. Let's talk about this Rams team. What do we know about it? What don't we know about it?
Obviously, a much different look on the defensive side. No more Aaron Donald. He retired going into this season, so we don't have to worry about him. But that front is a young group that's been developing, and they're able to apply pressure on the quarterback decently. So that's going to be something to watch out. Meanwhile, on the offensive side of the ball, man, you got a guy that's, to me, an elite signal caller, and a Matthew Stafford back there. You can't give him time to pick apart this Saints defense, which we saw him do last year on Thursday Night Football when it was in L.A. You got targets like Puka Nacua, Cooper Kupp, and then a run game, Kyren Williams. But the good news with Kyren, he leads the NFL running backs in fumbles this year, so hopefully that Saints defense can take advantage of that.
Got to tackle him first, just to be clear. You got to get your priorities straight, right? Let me talk about the Rams linebackers. They got Omar Spates, the guy from LSU, who didn't really contribute a lot in Baton Rouge. He seemed like he was hurt a lot. He was a transfer from Oregon, if I remember, Oregon State. Tell me about that Rams linebacker crew.
Yeah, I mean, you got a mix, like you said, of Omar Spates, Christian Rosenblum, and then the guy that I was looking at the Saints potentially drafting, and some of my mock drafts had him go into the black and gold in Florida State linebacker Jared Verse. Mm-hmm. Good pass rusher, has 4.5 sacks his rookie year. So that's going to be a group to keep an eye on. But hopefully this one game of the black and gold can continue to evolve. I think we saw, obviously, Taysom Hill the last outing against the Cleveland Browns get utilized a lot more. And Darren Rizzi talked about that going forward, being able to maximize that versatility of Taysom going forward, whether it's run, pass, or receiving. And then with a guy like Alvin Kamara, who's just been a stud all year long for this black and gold bunch, even though he's been banged up, he's still on the field doing what he can and making a difference.
What about the Los Angeles Rams offensive line?
Yeah, the O-line group they've been up and down in games. There's some matchups where Matthew Stafford's gotten sacked. He's felt that pressure a few times in these other games. They've been able to keep him clean. But obviously in those matchups where Stafford's felt the pressure and has gotten the sacks this season, he has not been as elite as a signal caller. Nobody would be when you don't have time to get rid of the ball. And that's a huge key for this Saints team. We saw they were able to at least get to Jameis Winston in the second half of that Cleveland matchup, but for most of the game, I felt like he had way too much time to pick the Saints secondary apart, and because of that, finished with pretty decent numbers. Jameis Winston, he had a good game against the Saints, just didn't end up on the winning side, so pressure going to be key, and we've seen this Rams offensive front fold before, so hopefully the pass rush of the black and gold, which has been, mensa this season. Hopefully they can dial things up and just make him uncomfortable in the pocket, because Matthew Stafford, we know, is not a guy that's going to take off, tuck it, and run. But if you give him enough time back there, he'll survey the field and find that open guy.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. Saints taking on the Rams, trying to make it 3 in a row. Let's hope they can. 8:50, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:56 now in the latest edition of the Odyssey Original Inside Black and Gold podcast. Saints are back in action for a 6-week sprint to the finish line. So who has the most to prove? Saints sideline reporter Jeff Nowak, WWL Sports Director Steve Geller break down the players with the most to prove the rest of the way on both offense and defense. Plus, share some thoughts on a wild weekend of football we actually got to watch and a lot more. Check out Inside the Black and Gold podcast, available wherever you get your podcast. The aforementioned Steve Geller spending some time with us now. Steve, talk about Darren Rizzi and the change in the team and just the rest of the season. You know, Jeff and I were talking the other day about being able to fan however you wanted. I'm not giving up on anything. Playoffs, I guess, would be still possible, obviously, but it's going to be a journey. Run down the rest of the season for me and realistically, best possible outcomes of what the Saints can accomplish, all that stuff.
Yeah, we heard Darren Rizzi talk about it yesterday, and the fact that he doesn't want his team to be obviously looking ahead. It's the old mantra of one game at a time. So they've been focused on the playing the LA Rams this week. But of course, as fans, we're always looking ahead and dreaming and thinking of what could be the rest of the way with this black and gold bunch. You look at some of the matchups after the Rams squad. You got a team like the New York Giants who have been reeling. Washington Commanders, Jaden Daniels has come down back to earth a little bit after a hot start for the rookie. That other tough game besides this Rams matchup for me, no doubt, in Green Bay, Monday Night Football, the end of December, going to be an interesting matchup. But we've seen this team thrive before and win in cold weather temperatures. Believe me, I was there on the sidelines in Cleveland for that negative temperature game. And then you come home, hosting the Las Vegas Raiders, who haven't been good this year. And then, obviously, it's always tough, a divisional matchup. You end up one. Who knows? This one could be flexed into primetime because the Saints are playing at Tampa Bay the rest of the way. Is closing out the year on a win streak, you know, winning the rest of your games likely? Probably not, but you can keep this hope alive under a guy like Coach Rizzi, who's bringing that energy right now. He says that players came back off this bye week, still dialed in, and focus on the task at hand, being good and executing at practice every single day. And I don't know, can they keep this mojo up under Rizzi? It'll be very interesting. Obviously, we know, too, this is a huge, basically, job audition for him the rest of the way. Can the Saints rely on him for next season, keep things in place a little bit to have maybe a little bit of continuity if you're seeing this team suddenly now gelling and bonding, playing for one another, which I think a lot of that fun was lost. And obviously during the 7-game losing skid, there wasn't a whole lot of fun going on. That's been back with the black and gold. We'll see if they can maintain it. I'm just enjoying this ride right now. And hopefully, you know what, I'm wishing for we get on this now a positive trend with winning, because the losing skid, you know, it sucked.
Yeah, it did. You got to get hot at the right time. You got to get healthy at the right time. Real quick, we got about 40 seconds left. Talk about the healthiness of the Saints, if you will.
Yeah, the one concern yesterday, not seeing center Eric McCoy at practice. We'll find out more today when the first injury report of the week comes out to see how he's dealing with that hamstring issue, the groin issue, sorry. Tano Passanio, good news, the defensive end is back. Going to be in that practice window now open after he suffered an Achilles injury. So some depth on the D-line could be in place.
All right, Steve, thank you. You and your family have a great Thanksgiving. Steve's got a Romo football player in his family. How many turkeys you got to cook for that young man? Two, three, how many?
Definitely, it's been, you know, eating me out of house and home as he grows older, for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine. Thank you, Steve. Enjoy it. God bless y'all. Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director, will come back, talk about keeping your food safe during Thanksgiving. Then we'll get some weekend winners with JR. All right, thank you, Dave. Have a nice Thanksgiving. And we're going to give you some food safety tips right now, as a matter of fact. Y'all, if you got any questions, comments, text them in to 504-260-1870. Because the last thing in the world you want for anybody to do is to get sick after eating something at your home. And I know when we were kids, it happened, and we were all sick, and it was just miserable. Janet Buffer joins us now, food safety expert of the George Washington University Milken Institute School of Public Health. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? Happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you as well. And I mentioned that when I was a kid, we all presumed it was oyster dressing that got everybody just deathly ill. And that's the problem with having the whole family over. And that doesn't mean that anybody is not a clean housekeeper or doesn't do, you know, everything they can. But sometimes people just don't know, right?
Exactly. Exactly. That is, people can be working in their kitchen and thinking they're doing everything correctly, but there's just a few tips and tricks that need to be put into place to make sure that everyone is safe with the foods that they cook and the leftovers that they store.
So I guess maybe we'll go chronologically. What's the best way to thaw frozen food if people didn't yet start thawing their turkey? Is it too late?
No, it's not too late. Of course, the best way to do it is in your refrigerator, but that does require you taking it out several days and 3 to 4 days from the freezer and put it in the refrigerator to defrost. Now, I have myself been known to wait way too long before taking my turkey out of the freezer. Yes.
Really?
I will tell you, I did it last year, to be quite honest. So you can, and this is the next best way, is to put it into a sink with cold running water. So plug your sink, put some cold water in, submerge your turkey, let it defrost in the cold water. It may require you to change the water every now and then, but that is another acceptable way to defrost it.
And then you can use the water that you soak the turkey in as a refreshing beverage, right? Just kidding. I'm kidding.
No, absolutely not, Tommy.
No, but seriously, no. When it comes to that kind of thing, you know, they got me so afraid now with poultry and washing chicken and all of that. Because if you do wash the chicken before you cook it, you kind of spread that all over, right? So when it comes to the turkey after you do thaw it in its wrapper, how do you handle it from that point to keep from spreading stuff all over the place?
Exactly. So, and I do leave my turkey in the wrapper when I'm defrosting it in the sink. And then, but always, because there's a chance for the juices to leak out, that's always a potential. So once you've drained the water from your sink, be sure to wash it with warm soapy water and rinse it really well.
Wait.
If you
soapy
do have
water?
An antimicrobial, warms after you drain the, so once you remove the chicken from the sink and you drain the water, then wash your sink with warm soapy water.
I thought you were washing a bird with warm soap.
No. Please do not wash your chicken with warm soapy water. Do not wash your turkey or your chicken at all. Do not do that at all. Just open the package and put it in the roasting pan and roast it.
So when it comes to brining, What about that and, mm-hmm. and temperature and all of that stuff? Somebody texted in.
Okay. Brining is great. I'm brining mine with a sugar and salt mixture right at the moment. It's a dry brine. Mm-hmm. So I've rubbed it onto the bird, and then I put that bird back into the refrigerator to brine. If you're submerging it in a salt and or sugar or both brine, and you the same thing, you want to make sure you put that back in the refrigerator. So it should always stay chilled. Do not leave your bird out on the counter or to brine on the counter for several hours. Put it back into the refrigerator to brine.
So if you have one of those, or if you do plan on brining it, and you got to put it in an ice brine solution?
If it's in the refrigerator?
Well, no. I guess somebody told me a long time ago they brined a turkey by putting it in a half salt, half water solution in an ice chest. But if you were going to do that, you got to have ice all over the turkey or what? Do you not do it that way?
No, if you're going, gosh, that could be a challenge. And I realize space is an issue, but if you're going to try and brine, but you definitely want to keep that bird below 41 degrees. I think that is really the information that everyone should have. If you're going to do any sort of brining, it has to stay chill. So whatever.
Let me take
you
a step back.
To keep that bird below
Janet,
41 degrees, that's what you want
to
do.
The best way to brine a turkey would probably be the place to start here, so we don't send people down the wrong road.
Okay, thank you. In the refrigerator. Please brine your turkey in the refrigerator. Yes.
So you put it in a bag and if you're not going to do a dry brine.
If you're going to do a liquid brine, and you will put it in a container with water, with your sugar salt mixture, submerge your bird in that water, but put it back in the refrigerator.
So you're going to need a pretty big container if you plan on doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Somebody else texted in, said here, smoking a 13-pound turkey today, should I put it in the refrigerator overnight, then warm up for tomorrow for lunch? And that is a problem. I know sometimes they get fried turkey where people pick them up a day ahead of time. I always hated that because that goes to the rule of how many times can you reheat something, right?
Right. But no, that's fine. If they picked up their bird today and it's ready, then yes, go put it in the refrigerator. And then when they pull it out the next day, reheat it.
But what about after that, reheating it and leftovers?
So then we get into the leftovers. So they've reheated this item, and then how long is this bird? The meat should not be sitting out for more than 2 hours. So I'm assuming we're talking about they're reheating this bird and putting it out on the table for consumption.
I don't mean to make it confusing, but let me go back and make it, begin at the beginning, which is, You reheat it, you got it, it was cooked, right? Then it cooled and you refrigerated it. Now you're heating it again to serve it, so it's been reheated once. How many times do you get to reheat it? Because if you pick it up the second time.
You can reheat it again, but you just need to make sure that when you reheat to a temperature of 165 degrees, and that's critical. The thing that will happen with that second is that the quality of the product will change. When you reheat,
I guess more than once. Yeah, what I'm trying to get to is how many times can you make something a leftover?
From a food safety standpoint, like I said, you can do this multiple times.
Really?
If you reheat to 165 degrees. Yes.
Really?
But I'm telling you, yes, but. The quality of that product, the flavor of that product, the texture of the product is going to get to a point where it is really not pleasant to consume. So from a food safety standpoint, if you are handling your leftovers correctly, so you have that food out, you put it back in the refrigerator within a 2-hour period, and that's important, that food should not be sitting at room temperature for longer than 2 hours. So you have that product. It sits at room temperature. You put it back in the refrigerator within 2 hours. Okay, you take it out to reheat it. You reheat it to a temperature of 165. And I'm going to say you must use the thermometer to know what that temperature is. And again, I'll give you some anecdotal evidence of that.
Okay.
I was reheating a dish, And I was had it in a pot. I had it on the stove. It was nice and bubbly and hot and steaming. I took the temperature, and it was 155. So I needed to let it cook for longer, to heat for longer, before it got to that 165 degrees. And then when I tasted it, I didn't like it. It did not taste well. So I ended up throwing the item out. It was a beef and bean dish is what it was. So it's really important that you reheat to 165 degrees. That's the temperature that will keep food safe, leftovers safe, if you want to reuse them.
Hey, and I'm getting some text here. I'm making it confusing and confusing people, and I don't mean to do that. The only thing I'm just... I was brought up with, you reheat it one time, then you throw it away. I'm just astounded that you can reheat it more than one time, but the problem is it's not going to taste ideal, right?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
But along those lines, Janet, what about tasting something or smelling something? How do you know when it's gone bad and that you shouldn't even fool with it?
So there's a difference between spoilage and an item that's safe. So for items, if you're trying to see, taste, or smell food that could harm you, you can't. You cannot see, taste, or smell pathogens. If there is a harmful bacteria in your food, you cannot taste it. So therefore, that's why handling food appropriately is important. So you cook to the proper final cooking temperature, you put leftovers away within a two-hour period, you reheat properly, and you keep items at 41 degrees or below in your refrigerator to keep it cold. So hot food's hot, cold food cold. If spoiled foods, mm-hmm. if food is spoiling, that's when you will see, taste, or smell a change. And spoilage typically does not cause harm, but food pathogens will cause harm.
Somebody texted in, we'll have to take a break and answer we come back. They eat steaks for Thanksgiving, and they said they have about $200 of steaks that have been in the freezer for a year. Is it okay to eat? We'll answer when we come back with Janet Buffer, food safety expert at the George Washington University Milken Institute School of Public Health. She's our good friend. She's been on before. We're trying to keep everybody from getting sick. Another text comes in. What about cold leftovers? We'll talk about that. Somebody else said, should you remove the turkey from the bone for storage after cooking? Somebody else wants to know, how long do you leave it on the counter? How hot does it have to be, or how cool does it have to be before you pick it up? A lot of questions coming in. 504-260-1870. We just want everybody to be happy and healthy for Thanksgiving. Back in a flash, WWL. .928, talking to Janet Buffer, food safety expert at the George Washington University Milken Institute School of Public Health. And a text comes in, and it says, I'm not trying to be difficult, and we appreciate the courtesy there, but they didn't quite fully understand about reheating the dishes with, can you reheat the whole dish, or do you just want to take a portion of it out to reheat leftovers? Explain that, if you will, Janet, please.
Sure. It's anything. If you take the dish out of the refrigerator, let's go backwards. You've taken the food off the counter and you've put them in a container, mm-hmm. and you store them in your refrigerator at 41 degrees or below. And then you're ready to take those leftovers out several hours after you've eaten or the next day. So you remove that container. You may reheat if it's a food safe grade, food safe, a container that's safe to use in the microwave. You can reheat the whole container of food. It just must be to 165 degrees. Or you take out a spoonful of an item and put it on a plate with some other items. It just still needs to be heated to 165 degrees Fahrenheit.
All right. Not trying to make it complicated, but the devil is in the details. Somebody else says, what about cold leftovers? I guess they mean, do you have to reheat them? I guess is what they mean.
The adage is hot food's hot, cold food's cold. So if you have, let's say, cut fruit that should always stay cold at 41 degrees or below, you take that out of the refrigerator and you eat that cold. If you have a salad that's left over, you're going to want to eat that cold. So things that are that are to be served cold should be stored cold and then consumed as a leftover cold.
Should you remove the turkey from the bone for storage after cooking?
I don't really have an opinion on that. It's from a base perspective. Yes, it's probably a good idea, but you can put the whole turkey in the refrigerator. The most important thing is that it's kept cold after it's been removed from the counter and it's being stored.
This I definitely want to get to, and that is the dressing cooked inside of the turkey as opposed to outside of the dressing, outside of the turkey. Please talk about that, Janet.
Thank you for bringing that up, too. That is so important that when you have stuffed that turkey and you are roasting it, when you take the temperatures to make sure that your turkey has reached at least 165 degrees, and you want to take the temperature in the thickest part of the breast, you want to take it in the thigh, you can also take it around the wing, but you also must take that temperature of the stuffing. That is so important. And make sure that the tip of that thermometer gets all the way into the middle of the stuffing that's in the turkey. Mm-hmm. And it is definitely at 165 degrees. And again, I'll give you a little story here. And it was, so not me, but a food safety professional that I know. He was at his Thanksgiving dinner, and he was very concerned that the stuffing did not get to the right temperature. He even called it out to his family member. He chose not to eat the stuffing, and other members did, and people did get sick with salmonella. They definitely got sick. So it is so important to take that temperature.
This is not a health issue. It is a health issue, I guess, a judgment I'm trying to say, Janet, but it would seem to me, if you look at the upside and the downside and the marginal difference of cooking the dressing inside of the bird, it would seem as though, if you're going to err on the side of caution, it would be make a lot more sense not to put the stuffing in the bird.
Yes, okay. Yes, definitely. You still want to take that temperature, though. It still needs to get nice and hot. But
I'm just saying about the dressing. Rather than risk it, it's probably a lot safer just to cook it separate, because I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference in terms of the flavor.
Yeah.
This is an interesting text. Cooking turkey and ham, can both of them sit on the counter for the same amount of time? And while we're talking about that, Janet, you know, sometimes it's not just a meal. People leave food out and people pick at it the entire afternoon while they're watching football. What's the best way to do that? And you can also bring up warming trays or whatever else as we talk about this.
Okay. So first part of the question, the turkey and the ham can sit out on the counter, again, no longer than 2 hours. So they can sit on the counter, and then you're going to want to put them away into the refrigerator to keep them cold. Then if people do want to graze for the afternoon, you can pull those products back out and put them on the counter. Again, I would not. This is going to get a little tricky.
Well, that's all right. Look, Janet, you know what? People, they can go back. They can download the Odyssey app. They can go to WWL.com, click on my name, and rewind or listen at their convenience. But the devil is in the details on this, is it not?
It is, yes, because you want to put those products back in the refrigerator, and you want them to cool down to below 41 degrees. You want those products to be cold. Okay, so if you're going to graze for the afternoon, you can pull that product out of the refrigerator, make your sandwich, reheat, but put it back in the refrigerator to keep it chilled. I would not keep putting it in the refrigerator and pulling it out throughout the period of the day, because it's not giving the item a long enough time to get down to a chilled temperature. So if you're going to graze, okay, just pull the product out, make your plate, put the product back in the refrigerator. If it's hot foods that should be hot, you can reheat them to 165 degrees. If it's cold foods, just eat them cold. But make sure that your leftovers stay in the refrigerator so they can get down to a cold temperature.
So I was watching one of these Gordon Ramsay shows one time, and he just reamed somebody because they had condensation in a package that they had put in the refrigerator. But yet they say you're supposed to pick it up. I don't know. At what point do you put food into the refrigerator? Can it be too warm when you put it in the refrigerator? And is it about the food, or is it about bringing down the temperature of the refrigerator?
It's a little bit of both. So when you have hot foods, you wouldn't take something directly out of the oven and put it into the refrigerator, steaming, steaming hot. You really want that product to come down to about room temperature, which is about that 2 hour period, right? Okay. And then you put it into the refrigerator. If you put it into the refrigerator hot and you seal it, you're not giving that item enough time to cool, what we call getting through the temperature danger zone quickly enough. And this is a whole another concept. But when you cook foods and they get to temperatures, you know, well above 135, you know, they can be 160, 165. But product food needs to get through the temperature zone of 135 down to 70 degrees within a 2 hour period. So think about that. You have your product, you put it out on the counter, it's steaming hot. It's coming down to room temperature as it's sitting on that counter for about 2 hours. Then you can put it in the refrigerator and chill it back down to 41 degrees.
I got a couple of questions. I got to get back to that. Go ahead. Finish, Janet. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's fine. Go ahead.
I got to get back to that frozen steak thing, too, because I never get back to that. But somebody got a couple of different texts coming in here. There's nothing wrong if the turkey has been properly refrigerated with eating cold turkey out of the refrigerator on a sandwich, correct?
Absolutely not. Nope, that is perfectly fine.
Have a blast. So let's talk about this person got $200 of frozen steaks they've been sitting on for a year. They eat steaks at Thanksgiving. They want to make sure that the steak is okay to eat. Can you keep something frozen for a year? And if when you open a package, they say it's vacuum sealed, how do you know if it's good or not?
It's fine. That steak is just going to be fine being frozen for a year. When you have products that are stored in the freezer, it doesn't necessarily kill the bacteria, but it certainly slows any sort of growth down. And when they're cooking that steak, most likely anything's going to be on the outside of it. So if they're cooking that to the proper temperature, which is about 145 degrees, it's going to kill that bacteria on the outside of the steak. So their steaks are fine.
Popped up, too, about steaks and vacuum packs. They said they took it out of the freezer and they had a slime on the outside. Does that mean anything?
Of the steak or
of the
vacuum
slime
pack?
Not the package, the steak itself, when they took it out of the package after defrosting it.
That may just be the moisture that was retained next to the steak while it was defrosting. But if there's any question, I would not consume it.
When in doubt, throw it out.
Any sort of question, I would throw it away.
Thank you, Janet. I appreciate your time. Have a nice Thanksgiving. We love talking to you as always. Janet Buffer, food safety expert at the George Washington University Milken Institute School of Public Health, 938, 22 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. All right, here we go. Special Wednesday edition because it is, I would think, JR, one of the bigger football. First of all, good morning, JR. How you doing?
I'm doing outstanding. Happy Football Friday, Tommy.
Yes, sir. Same to you, although it's Wednesday. I think
It is a happy football Wednesday. What am I talking about?
You know what it is? I like Thanksgiving in a way almost more than Christmas because it's 4 days, right, of fun and family and food and football and all that stuff. And not to take anything away from Christmas. I'm just saying you got 4 days all together there and the excitement's in the air already. Tell me, first of all, about a mindset that people should have going into this big 4-day weekend of all kinds of professional and college football.
First off, I absolutely love this time of year. I know there's a lot of bah humbugs out there that got to go spend money, and you know they get a little crazy about this holiday season. They don't look forward to it. Listen, I got 6 kids. I've been married 27 years, and I love the holiday. I love Thanksgiving. I'm going to have more than 30 people at my house tomorrow, and we are going to party. We're going to watch football. We're going to make money, and we're going to eat like crazy. It's going to be awesome. So right out the gate, I'm going to hook you guys up with the big winner of this Chicago-Detroit game absolutely free. The line's been going from 9 to 10.5, back and forth all over the place. I'm going to give you this winner free of charge via text message. All you got to do, text the word win to 545454 right now. Get the winner of the Bears-Lions game 100% free via text message. All you got to do, text the word win to 545454 to get that winner. And look,
the mistake guys make is they come into Thanksgiving and they start firing it in right away, and all of a sudden, by the time they get to the turkey, they're already down money, they're miserable, their family is around, and they want to go home. Yeah. Don't make that mistake. Have an expert on your side that not only wins like crazy, but is capable of telling you the right way and the amounts that you should be putting based on your bankroll, guys, to give you the strategy so that you got a smile on your face no matter what. Whether you win or lose that first and second game, by the time you get to turkey, we're going to have you up money and we're going to have you doing dances around the turkey table. So give us a shout. Get this winner between Chicago and Detroit for free. Text WIN to 545454.
The turkey table dance. You know, the other thing, JR, I was thinking of, when you look at this game, the second game, you got the Giants without Daniel Jones, who I think signed with Walmart, I heard today.
Yeah, well, that's the one you got to take a nap for.
Well, not necessarily, because there might be, and I don't know what kind of information you have based on money line movement on this or the other thing, there could be some opportunities with that game to maybe find a winning opportunity and have some action on the game where there is something to watch for, right?
No question. We're going to be betting all three of these games. Anyone that's a client of ours will be getting what's called the turkey shoot. So you will get all three of those games. We're going to make it a fantastic turkey day. But if you're going to go all day, let's face it, you're going to eat, you're going to have a nap. If you're going to nap during any game, it's going to be the Giants-Cowboys game that maybe you fall out for that 45 minutes on the couch and wake back up with a kid throwing a football on your lap. So look, if you really want to do things the right way, you got to have somebody that really not only knows what they're doing and can win like crazy, but like I said, we're going to help you as to how you should roll over a portion of what you make on game one onto game two, and then another portion of what you made on the first two going on to game three. So no matter what, you walk out of this day, you walk out of Thanksgiving with some money in your pocket and food stuffed in your belly.
That's what we're all looking for. How about the college football games this weekend? What's got your attention? What doesn't?
You know, I got to tell you, man, we've been just on fire in college football. College football is, obviously coming towards the end of the season. We're going to be getting into the championship game soon. We're going to be getting into, of course, the playoff, which is going to be a 12-team playoff for the first time. So I got to tell you, man, I am pumped up. I am excited, and I couldn't be more excited about some of the games that we've got this weekend. We've already actually put out. There's one game in particular. I'm not going to say which game it is, but there's one game in particular we absolutely love, and we're already putting our clients on it this far in advance. So I got to tell you guys, if you really want to do things the right way, you know, over here at Taking Vegas, we've got all of the tools, all of the resources, all of the right pieces in place. I'm going to have the winner of that Oklahoma-LSU matchup. I'll tell you right now, the line on that game is -6. It's going to be in Baton Rouge. This is not a game you want to try to bet on your own. Again, you want to be able to get the information that we're going to be releasing on this matchup. And along with the big winner tomorrow with the Lions and the Bears. Again, listen, Chicago, since they've gotten rid of Waldrum, it's a bit of a different offense. He's distributing the football. He's running with it when he needs to. Caleb Williams, I'm talking about. So they look like a different team, but at the same time, they're going against a Lions team that's scoring more points in the NFL than any other team, and their defense is number one or two right now as far as allowing points. So they are a ruthless, relentless team. But will Chicago be able to slow them down to the tune of 9.5, 10 points? I'm going to let you know, guys. It is absolutely free, and I send it to you via text message. All you got to do, text the word WIN to 545454. Get the winner of the Lions-Bears game absolutely free. Sign on with us. Get the turkey shoot. Get our college football, and let us roll you into Sunday with a huge profit and nothing but excitement for Sunday NFL. WIN. Text WIN to 545454.
What I think is so interesting about what you do is it's not just about X's and O's, or, well, it is about numbers, but not the numbers on the backs of the players. It's about numbers in terms of money movement. You're watching all of that, aren't you?
We are. Not only do we have to look at the matchups, and we got to look at, you know, past performances of teams that are, you know, just like another team that they're going against, same types of defenses, same types of offense that a defense is seeing. You got to look at everything. And then we go look at the money. We got to watch the money flow coming into the games. And a lot of what we're looking for is that quote unquote institutional money is what I call it. Used to be known as smart money or sharp money.
I'm looking for the big numbers that are coming in. We're talking about groups that move large amounts of money, mainly by proxy, where they've got other people moving in and out for them. So you got to be able to, you know, really capitalize on understanding and watching that money flow coming in and out of these games, something we specialize in as well as the matchups. And when we get something that really hits our radar hard, guys, that's when we pounce and that's when we make a big score for our clients.
And you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them. It's not about winning every game, because you're not going to win every game.
You're just not. You're going to lose. I mean, I'm one of the few guys in this business that talks about it, because everyone wants you to think that all they do is win. That's just not the case. I mean, we win like crazy, like an incredible percentage of our games. We win like nuts. But at the end of the day, it does come down to managing and making sure that when you do get those two losses, sort of like here, look, I hit 7 in a row for you guys here on air. We were 7-0. Now we're 10-3. So that means that, let me just take a look at it for yourself. We've went 3-3 the last 6 games. That means that if you're just betting them straight for the same amount of money, you're dead even the last 6 games, 7 games above 500 if you've been doing it all season. But you know what? If you're a client of ours, we've got you lowering your bets as you lose a game or two. And then when things go back to the way they're supposed to, like they will this week, you start to pile it on. That's the way you do it. And you got to have the right percentage points, the amount of money you should be increasing, whether it's 10%, 20%, 30%, 50%. We're going to help you with that. We're going to tell you exactly how you should be doing it so that you can get to the finish line in first place.
All right, give us a free pick, JR, and then take us out.
You got it, guys. I'm going to come in with this one. I'm going to tell you now, this is as easy as they get. You got the Brian Flores defense taking on the Arizona Cardinals, who have their D has definitely stepped up the last few weeks. Both of these teams not allowing a lot of points on either side of the football. Special teams has been great. The punters have been outstanding. I'm looking for this game to go way under 45 points. Cardinals, Vikings, 1 p.m. Eastern, noon Central time on Sunday. That one's yours free. Go under 45, guys, under 45, Cardinals, Vikings. Now, look, big, big blowout winner. Again, I'm going to give you the winner of this Lions-Bears game absolutely free, and it comes to you via text message. All you got to do, text the word WIN to 545454. Get the winner of the Bears-Lions game via text message free of charge. Text WIN to 545454. I mean this absolutely sincerely, guys. Be safe this holiday season. Get home safe. Have fun with your family. And, of course, more than anything else, let's go out there and make some money.
Happy Thanksgiving, JR.